Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Anybody remember the first big bailout of the financial crisis? It wasn't a bank or an insurance company. It was a couple of mortgage companies you might have heard of. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a couple of $100 billion. Federal regulators said today they've got a plan to make sure that never happens again, which is good to know, I suppose. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 18th of February today. There are, depending on how you count them, about a million reasons the real estate market went bust. One very big one, no matter how you count, is that the government-owned mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bought up huge numbers of subprime loans. Today, there was a very small step toward cleaning up the housing mess, limiting Fannie and Freddie's exposure to those subprimes. From Washington, Brett Neely reports.
The proposed rules could take Fannie and Freddie out of the subprime business. Before the crisis, the companies bought up subprime mortgages. That essentially gave the mortgages a government seal of approval. Fannie and Freddie got to count those loans toward their affordable housing goals from the government. Kathleen Day is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
It was crazy that the government said, you can count towards your housing goal these mortgages that lenders were making without regard to whether the borrower could repay them.
Borrowers will notice the difference under the proposed new rules, says Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute.
It's going to be harder for low-income Americans to get subprime or other non-prime loans. If they have down payments, if they have unblemished credit, they will be able to get loans in the normal way.
Wharton professor Susan Wachter says it's a principled step in the right direction as the government rethinks Fannie and Freddie's role in the housing market.
It's a recognition that subprime lending and sustainable homeownership do not go together.
She also thinks the proposed regulations could help drive the housing market in a healthier direction. But Kathleen Day also sees the rules with a measure of regret.
It would have been wonderful if this had been put in place in 2003, 2004.
She says this rule alone wouldn't have prevented the meltdown, but it would have been a big help. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Healthcare will reappear on the national agenda next week. President Obama is going to convene a summit with congressional leaders to try to move things forward. The cost of Medicare is sure to come up at some point, which means a study today in the Journal of Health Affairs could not have come at a more opportune time. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Researchers at Emory University say they've learned what's behind Medicare's ballooning costs. They looked at Medicare expenditures over 20 years. In 1987, hospital care was driving Medicare costs up. Today, it's outpatient treatment for seniors with chronic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure, both linked to obesity.
We have talked about it in the past as a hidden fat tax.
Lydia Ogden is a health policy analyst at Emory who co-authored the study.
Because what people don't realize is that they're paying for this in the form of higher spending in publicly financed programs.
Emory professor Kenneth Thorpe was the study's primary author. He says if we can keep obesity rates from rising over the next decade, Medicare can save a lot of money.
We can probably spend about 10% less in the Medicare program 10 years from now. But that means that we got to start today.
And by start, he means get off the couch and, yes, diet. Lydia Ogden says Medicare should start paying for tailored weight loss programs for people in their 50s who are overweight and on the verge of diabetes or heart disease.
It's not enough to tell people that they shouldn't have that cheeseburger. What does work is saying, you know, Mrs. Jones, here's your health profile. And these are the small steps that you can take.
Ogden says the reasons for Medicare's soaring costs have changed drastically, and Medicare needs to change, too, for its financial health and the health of older Americans. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but have you been to Sears lately? 10 or 15 years ago, the answer for a lot of us would have been, yeah, sure. Today, traditional department stores just aren't all that, so Sears has been working on ways to extend its most popular brands outside its stores. A couple of days ago, it announced plans to market Die Hard Battery through some other retailers, and today, it launched a new plan to franchise its Sears Auto Centers. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
When billionaire Eddie Lampert merged Sears with Kmart 5 years ago, many investors expected he'd spin off the most valuable parts of the stores, brand names like Kenmore, Craftsman, and Die Hard. The parts were considered more valuable than the once popular department store and discount chains themselves.
People got really excited, myself included. I was a shareholder back then as well.
Chad Brand runs Peridot Capital, an investment advisory firm. He says over time, he sold his stock.
The evolution of the company was just slow. They did very little, if anything.
Chicago-based retail analyst John McLanafee says customers have also been losing patience with the way the stores have been allowed to languish. He says these new moves may show that Sears is now heading in the direction many expected.
Their sales have been declining, and their market acceptance has eroded. So, you know, if they're not going to take on the whole and solve the problem of the whole, then they need to take the parts, the strongest parts, and maximize sales and customer acceptance from those parts.
Franchising lets Sears focus on cash flow with lucrative fees and a share of the profits while franchisees invest in establishing new stores. Sears Auto Centers used to be profit centers, but management problems have hurt sales in recent years. Retail consultant George Whalen thinks this move might change that.
They're certainly well known for their auto centers. They're certainly well known for their auto service. So I think putting somebody in, you know, a franchisee who's vested, has a vested interest in the success of the thing is a good idea.
And if it's successful enough, the whole auto center business could eventually be spun off, just as some investors expected all along. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A quick correction now from yesterday's broadcast. Our story from Haiti put Mercy Corps headquarters in the wrong place. It's actually in Portland, Oregon, as many proud Oregonians told us overnight. Traders on Wall Street showed their pride today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're a frequent visitor to stores like Whole Foods, you might have seen or even bought products made by Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods. The purveyor of fine grains and flours is just outside Portland, Oregon, and Bob Moore is the Bob in question. He just turned 81 years old, but instead of getting a gift, he gave one to his employees. He gave them the company. Earlier this week, Mr. Moore announced something called an employee stock ownership plan, a retirement plan funded by company stock, which means, in essence, that his 209 employees now own Bob's Red Mill. Bob Moore, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, happy birthday, I guess, a little bit belatedly.
Yeah, 81 on Monday.
I hear it's a very good age.
I guess it is. I got up that morning.
That's right. Tell me about this thing you did with your company. You gave it away.
Well, you know, you have to decide what you're going to do with a company. I started many years ago and began accumulating some of the most wonderful people in the world. Some of them have been with me for over 30 years. And you reach a certain point in your life, 81, we just said that, and you've got to decide what you're going to do. You can sell a company. We've had lots and lots of opportunities. There's just too many bad stories about what happens when going entities like our company are sold. The new owners don't always do what you think they should do, and they're not always kind to the employees. I just absolutely felt I had to come up with something that would work.
So you set it up as a retirement account, basically, right, for all your employees?
Yeah, it is, Raxley. But you realize, too, Kai, that when this thing pays out in 10 years, they're going to own the company. The owners, current owners, are paid off, and it's not theirs any longer. So the ESOP is a very rigidly controlled government program that is meant to serve the purpose of turnover in companies, and that's exactly the way we're dealing with it. Myself and my partners, there's four of us all together, felt that it was the best transition we could think of because we're all getting older. I'm 81. I have John, my partner, is pushing 70, and Denny's just a couple years behind him. Robert is the baby in the group, and he's he's in his 40s yet.
Care to characterize for me how big a gift this is, the dollar amount?
Oh, we're probably good for $80 million.
That's a pretty nice retirement account you just set up.
Yeah, I mean, they'll. It's firm things. You know, it's very regulated, and yeah, it is. And that's basically what it is. It's a protected for the employees.
I'll tell you, Mr. Moore, you don't sound like a guy who's just going to sort of hang it up one day and walk.
No, I don't want to hang it up. No, Kai, I don't want to. I come to work every day. I just love this place. I got a corner office with windows all around, and I'm just surrounded with memorabilia, pictures, and all kinds of things of my long life. And I just don't see any reason to give it up.
So you're still in charge then, right? You're still the boss?
Yeah, I still am. Well, I have the fiduciary responsibility of this whole thing, and until such time as it's paid off, why I have that responsibility. And I've chosen to be president. anyhow, yes, I am still in charge.
Bob Moore, the owner for now, I suppose, or maybe not even anymore, of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods up in Milwaukee, Oregon. Mr. Moore, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you very much, Kai.
The coming change of seasons has farmers in the Midwest a little bit rattled. They're worried about a springtime repeat of their past two growing seasons, when rains and cold threw planting completely out of whack. The lousy weather has been pretty good for some farm equipment makers, though. Jay Field took a trip to the National Farm Machinery Show in Louisville, Kentucky.
So there's this special tiller. A guy at the show tipped me off to it. When I finally found it at the back of an exhibition hall the size of an airplane hangar, a farmer named Shep Shepherd was quizzing the salesman.
If you set it on the like most aggressive, and you were to say 200 bushel corn ground in the fall, what percentage of residue do you think you're leaving? I mean, roughly.
Shepherd's got a problem. He raises corn and soybeans in northeastern Missouri, and every year after harvesting, there are lots of plant stalks left behind. But this past year, there was even more debris than normal.
The fall this year was just so wet, the harvest lasted forever, and there's still quite a bit of crop still left in the field and areas.
Shepherd needs to work this junk into the soil to get the best possible seed bed for his new crops. That usually means several trips with multiple pieces of equipment across all 3,000 acres he farms. It's manageable if the weather is dry. But 2 years ago, big floods hit the Midwest, and Shepherd couldn't start planting until June, shortening the growing season. His buddy Brad Cook, who farms 1,300 acres in Illinois, says the recent weather has given a whole new meaning to the word efficiency.
We're not going out there four different times to get a seed bed. We can't. As many acres as guys like him are farming, I mean, you know, I'm spread out over four counties. I mean, you don't have the manpower or the time. You got to have one pass type situation to get a seed bed.
Which explains why Cook and Shepherd are standing here, in front of this unremarkable but powerful super tiller. This red contraption breaks down residue, grinds it into the soil, and produces a plantable seedbed, all in one trip. Wisconsin's McFarland Manufacturing makes it, and efficiency has become a top selling point as the recession has forced farmers to cut back on replacing anything still serviceable, like combines and tractors.
This year, this last year that just passed in 2009, many of these sectors were down from last year, double digits.
Charlie O'Brien with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers says that companies are trying all sorts of strategies to sell more products, including the conquer Mother Nature approach. O'Brien says it makes sense.
People want to take weather as much as you can out of the equation.
Which didn't explicitly factor into McFarland's thinking when it designed its tiller 3 years ago. But worsening weather sure helped.
This is the real disc, it's called, so the McFarland real disc.
McFarland's sales associate Steve Pesek is showing off its attributes to me. I ask him how much it costs.
That machine there is $53,000.
Can you pay cash?
Yeah, we certainly accept cash. Yeah, credit card. Got it?
Let's get that credit card out.
Yeah, get the credit card. We'll take it right here.
Farmer Shep Shepherd and Brad Cook walk away chuckling, not quite ready to throw down 50 G's. They've got plenty of other distractions at this fair, courtesy of other companies like John Deere and Case. Toys like high-powered fertilizer spreaders or ultra-fast tractors equipped with joysticks and video screens. In Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Jay Field for Marketplace.
Coming up, teachers attempt a takeover.
It's exciting to have an opportunity to create a school that you have envisioned your entire career.
But first, let's do the numbers. Third time's a charm for Wall Street. That would be three straight days of gains. The Dow Industrials picked up 83 points, 0.8%, finished at 10,392. The NASDAQ added 15 points, 0.2%. Closed at 2241. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, 0.2%, wrapped up at 1,106. Credit, another batch of reassuring corporate earnings for much of today's rise. Priceline.com shares jumped more than 9% after nearly doubling its quarterly profit. Hewlett-Packard stock climbed more than 1% after the computer maker reported a 25% jump in first quarter earnings. Procter & Gamble stock advanced nearly 1% after the consumer products giant reported it is back on the growth track. Bond prices slid, though. The rate on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.80%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores February 23rd. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Department of Labor releases the Consumer Price Index, letting us know what urban consumers are paying for goods and services. Activists from around the world are at the Newseum in Washington for a human rights summit concluding tomorrow. And Oscar winner Benicio del Toro celebrates his birthday. He'll be 43. Currently, you can catch him in The Wolfman. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. While the boarders and skaters and skiers are up in Vancouver this week, college basketball fans are gearing up for a party of their own, a little thing they like to call March Madness, the NCAA tournament. And there will be some great games, no doubt, but also lots and lots of money. That's a truism not just about college hoops, but also about most big-time collegiate athletics. It is also the subject of Mark Yost's new book. It's called Varsity Green. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I bet you meet a lot of people in college athletics when you're writing a book about college athletics. It kind of makes sense. But just from the title of this book, it kind of seems like it's not always such a pretty picture.
It isn't. The most important thing I think I learned in this is that, you know, these are kids. When it comes right down to it, we see them do these amazing athletic things on the football field and on the basketball court here in a few weeks in March Madness. And I don't have an issue so much with these kids and some of the stupid decisions that they make. The thing that really shocked me when I began to look at this was the behavior of the adults. They're the ones that are supposed to be looking out for these kids, helping them make smart decisions, remind them that academics is just as important as athletics. And that is clearly not the message that's being delivered today.
It's not really all about the winning season then, is it?
It isn't. It never is. It's about the money. It's about this billion-dollar machine that parents willingly feed their kids into every day. And this idea that athletics is their way out of the ghetto or off the farm. And the reality is that that's not true. Of all the kids in the country who play high school basketball, 3% of those kids get some sort of a college basketball scholarship and go and play college basketball. Less than 2% of those kids have any kind of meaningful NBA career of a couple of years or more. But yet the message to these kids from the time they make their first jump shot is this is your way out. This is the thing you should be focusing on. If you practice and play by the rules, this is your ticket out. And the reality is it very, very rarely happens.
You compare the NCAA, not favorably, I should add, to Tony Soprano and the Mafia.
Well, it's a little bit of an author's license, but it was a creative way to get into a chapter about what sports economists call cartel theory. And, you know, Tony Soprano has all these front businesses that are seemingly legitimate, but they're just masking the real business, which is his illegal activities. In the NCAA, I think it's fair to say that their facade is amateurism, because when you look at the money involved in college athletics, it's anything but amateur. The only thing that's really amateur about it, and some people say criminal, and reminiscent of the plantation system, is the fact that the players aren't paid. They get tuition and room and board, but other than that, they're just free labor for a multi-billion dollar business.
That actually is not a bad segue to my last point, which is that you don't end this book really on a hopeful note.
We never, as a culture, talk about those 97 or 98% of kids who end up at college and they don't make it to the NBA or the NFL. They end up spending 2 or 3 years at college. They come out with 60 credits, and they don't know how to read or think. And then we're shocked when these kids end up in a dead end with nowhere to go. And unfortunately, that's the story that never gets told, but it's what happens to the vast majority of NCAA athletes. They end up with no pro contract, no degree, and no prospects for the future.
The book by Mark Yost about college athletics and youth athletics everywhere, actually, in this country, is called Varsity Green. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles Unified School District already has more than 150 charter schools, 158 to be precise. Next week, it's expected to hand over 36 more new or failing schools to outsiders, charter school groups, or nonprofits. Catch is that some of those groups don't want to work with the powerful Los Angeles Teachers Union. That means union jobs would be at risk, as well as the union's bargaining power. So the union is sponsoring groups of its own teachers to run the schools that are up for grabs. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
If you're a first grader in Los Angeles, you'd probably want to be in Josephine Miller's class.
We do not have homework.
Miller has taught at Hillcrest Drive Elementary for 8 years. The school's in a rough Los Angeles neighborhood. More than three quarters of the kids test below grade level, making Hillcrest one of LA's lowest performing schools.
I would say I would be worried about my child in this school.
The LA School Board is about to do something about failing schools like Hillcrest. It's going to let outside groups, like charters and nonprofits, come in and run them. Many of the groups have weak unions or none at all. They argue that union contracts make it nearly impossible to fire ineffective teachers.
There has to be a commitment to having the best teachers in these classrooms.
Corey Tate Rivar is president of an organization that runs charter schools and is bidding to run Hillcrest. Tate Rivar's schools renegotiate with teachers every year. Parents also have a say about who's at the blackboard.
They can absolutely demand the best teacher for their kid. There's no more, you know, hiding Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so because we like them. You know, that's just not acceptable.
Tate Rivar says her schools judge teachers on how well their students perform. And that's pretty common at charters. Unions generally oppose that way of evaluating teachers. And with 36 schools changing hands, the union could lose thousands of jobs to charters and nonprofits. So the union is backing groups of its own teachers to take over the schools. Miller, the first grade teacher, is part of a team vying to run Hillcrest.
It's exciting to have an opportunity to create a school that you have envisioned your entire career.
Unions have been helping groups of teachers run schools all over the country, in Boston, Denver, and Milwaukee. A.J. Duffy is president of the L.A. Teachers Union. He's been rallying support around the teachers in his city.
When we win, then the world will say that we can do a far better job than a private school or a charter school or an education management company.
How? The Hillcrest teachers say they'd commit to a longer school day, more activities after school. And rather than being judged on student test scores, they'd evaluate each other. Some of those plans may put them at odds with their union contract. Henry Levin is a professor at Columbia University's Teachers College.
There are going to be some challenges because their agreements are not necessarily compatible with this kind of school.
Miller says the teachers are working with the union to make sure their contract gives them the leeway they need.
If we fail in this, public education will succumb to privatization.
If they succeed, they will create a school with intensive programs in music, technology, and social justice. Each student would get an individual learning plan to bring them to grade level.
We're talking about creating a school where kids feel valued. And why am I crying here?
Miller and fellow teachers have been working on the Hillcrest bid nonstop for months. If the union does hold on to the school, Miller says teachers will not only keep their jobs at Hillcrest, but they'll finally give themselves a weekend without homework. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it is a tad on the wonky side. We've been talking for a couple of months now about how the Fed's going to start pulling back all the excess cash that it's plowed into the financial system. The Fed's exit strategy has been the buzzword. It's kind of a good question, mostly because this has never been done on this scale before. Anyway, today, Mr. Bernanke and company took their first substantive step in that direction. They announced an increase in something called the discount rate, what banks have to pay for emergency cash. It's not a huge increase. It's just a quarter percentage point. Still, though, you got to start somewhere. Watch this one in the markets come tomorrow morning, by the way. But for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 83 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 2/3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, the rise and fall of certain celebrity lookalikes.
The day after he died, it was almost kind of macabre. They were canceling Elvis's and canceling all the Marilyn's just to have Michael Jackson. All the people wouldn't have him for bar mitzvahs. They want him now.
Oh, my goodness. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.